I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. Either my watch is slow or that clock is fast, but anyway, appropriate time having arrived. We'll start with the approval of the minutes. Representative Olson?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from February 24th.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. First bill up this morning is the RFA bonding. We'll need to have a motion to put the bill before us, Representative Poppy.
Yes, I move House File 2959 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Would you care to explain the bill?
Many people know about this bill, but House File 2959 borrows $50 million from the bond market to appropriate proceeds to the Rural Finance Authority, otherwise known as RFA. The RFA is the state's main ag lending arm, and replenishing the funds is a top priority for the ag sector. The purpose of the bonds issued is to purchase participation interest in ag real estate loans. The bonds sold are user-backed general obligation bonds, although they do not require a three-fifths majority vote, like you see in the larger capital investment bills. So this is a bill that can move separately, and it is something that we would like to see happen. The RFA offers low-interest loan programs to farmers by partnering with local lenders to provide affordable credit to eligible farmers. And I would like to see it pass today so that we can act on this very quickly.
I think it's a fair chance that might happen, but any discussion? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chair Poppy, for bringing this forward. My question is, you know, we're into March. We have 50-degree weather in the forecast. When do you think we can expect this on the House floor so that we can continue this moving forward, get it signed into law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton. I'm hoping that we are looking at adding some days during the week here. We may be able to see it this week. I don't have confirmation on that, but that is my supposition at this point.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, would you care to renew your motion?
I would. I renew my motion that House File 2959 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Our next bill is House File 3633, Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I move that House File 3633 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, and Representative Pawlowski, there's an amendment in our packets. Would you like to explain the bill or take the amendment?
Why don't I explain the bill first, and then we'll let the amendment be offered, and we'll discuss the amendment.
Okay, Representative Pawlowski.
This is the third time in less than a year that we are going to replenish the disaster contingency account. If you recall that last year, the account had been drained, and we had put $10 million in by April 1st, and I think it was on April 1st, which is an appropriate date that the governor signed the bill. Subsequent to that, we had $20 million that was put in during the session, and then we went to special session, and some of you know that there is nothing special about a special session. And the money that and eventually that was put into the account, I had to ask on the House floor. I asked Representative Mariani. He didn't have it. Representative Mahoney didn't have it. Representative Torkelson came over and explained to me it was in the transportation account. And apparently Representative Hornstein wasn't even aware it was in the transportation account. And it was coming from a fund, a transit fund, I believe, that if it overfilled, then it would be put in the disaster account. That overfill didn't occur really till October. And interestingly enough, it occurred when we were having a hearing on not only disaster, but also on a number of other things in Rushford, which was the epicenter of the 2007 largest disaster in the history of the state. And it was then finally filled, I think that was October 3rd of last year. So here we are again, and we need the account for a number of reasons. Chapter 12A and Chapter 12B work when the president or the governor declare a national disaster or a natural disaster. When they do that, a series of protocols immediately go into place. What we found out in 2007 was that if you wait weeks, which is what we did, it only increases the cost, and you are putting people and property in harm's way. So, members, I would hope I would get you support today. We have another bill identical to this moving in the Senate, which, interestingly enough, is being carried by Senator Miller, a former student of mine, and hopefully we'll get this to the governor's desk as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you. And there is an amendment in the packet, Representative Garofalo. I think you're the one that submitted the amendment. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Representative Pawlowski, the A2 amendment, what it does is it really prioritizes the resources that are available to expand the disaster contingency account. As you know, at some point in this process, we're going to have budget targets, and there's going to be items that are suggested people want to spend money on. Some things good, some things not so good. And in my opinion is that we should be prioritizing this account over those areas. And before I formally move the amendment, I just want to get your feedback on if it's something that I should move, or perhaps you want to move the amendment so that would increase its chances of passage in this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, it's your amendment, and I'll let you stay with it, but I will speak to the amendment. When we had the hearing on this bill in the Greater Minnesota Committee last week, I asked Director Kelly specifically to tell me if we had a disaster the size of 2007, what we would need in the account. He testified then at least $40 million. If we had a disaster approximately the size of Duluth, which was the second largest disaster in the history of the state, we'd need $30 million. So we're in the process now of working with leadership to figure out how to fund this account in such a way that, first of all, I would suggest it has to be permanently funded. It can't just be funded every time. It needs to be funded. And then to what extent that funding should take place. And I would say it would be significantly larger than the bill we're looking at now.
So,
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, and perhaps I should ask you, do we have an estimate of when we're going to have budget targets for the 2020 session? When do we think we're going to know what the...
I didn't bring Representative Garofalo the calendar with me, but do you remember there is a date that's kind of our goal, about the 23rd.
What month?
the month was March.
Okay, thank you, yeah. Mr. Chair.
At any rate, that will be the goal. It could happen sooner, but I suspect it'll be about the 23rd.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and
that's what we've tentatively penciled in at any rate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, I'm not going to formally move the A2 amendment then, because it sounds like there may be less of a chance of it succeeding than I'd like. Certainly, if someone from the majority wants to move it, I would be supportive of it. But I just, Representative Pawlowski, I do think it's important that this is an item that I'm glad that it's traveling by itself. I actually disagree with you that it should be just put into the forecast base. The more bills we can have traveling by themselves as individual items, the better. In addition, this is something that should be a priority for funding this session, especially given the resources we have. But I recognize that there's a power structure we all work within, so I won't offer the amendment. But Representative Pawlowski, I would encourage you, as well as members of the majority party, to consider expanding those resources that are available in that account. So thank you.
Hey, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would publicly like to thank Representative Pawlowski for his work on this. As he mentioned in his testimony, this was basically the result of the largest disaster in Minnesota history, which was in the Rushford area, Houston County, Fillmore County, Winona County. And Representative Pawlowski at that time, I was on my 45-vote two-year vacation, but Representative Pawlowski stepped up and really did a great job, not only for our area but for the entire state. And it does save not so special sessions from occurring, because the statute just says how we do this. So I think this is a good bill, and we need to move it forward. Thank you, Representative Pawlowski.
Representative Herkhaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to also echo those same comments of support. Thank you, Representative Pawlowski, for carrying this legislation. You helped clarify. How these monies are used, and you mentioned that either a presidential declaration of disaster or the governor declaring a disaster. And I think it's important to have this contingency fund where we can get money and resources to where it's needed quickly. And so I support that, and not having to call a special session of the legislature to appropriate the money. That said, however, I am concerned a little bit about in times of urgency, things seem to cost a lot of money, and that's just the nature of the contracting world. And could you tell me, is there any other internal oversight with regard to the governor declaring a disaster and then just deciding how much money to appropriate? Is there conference with legislative leaders, or is there any other mechanism in place? And should we, if not, should we have some type of mechanism that can still respond quickly but not require a convening of the legislature?
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hertaus, Chapter 12B was created so that the governor has to consult with House and Senate leadership before an announcement is made, so the understanding is mutual in both the legislative bodies. So, yes. And then I will also say that Chapter 12B was created as a result of the legislative auditor during a thorough study in 2012 of Chapter 12A. And then Chapter 12B was built in part around the recommendations of the legislative auditor, because Chapter 12B or Chapter 12A only went into place when a presidential disaster was declared. The number of disasters since the 2007 were approximately 9 at that time, and they were not sufficient enough to call a presidential disaster. So then a gubernatorial disaster was created, and this account was created in order to address those smaller disasters that did not rise to the level. But no local unit of government can sustain the amount of resources or the cost of a disaster. So there's no city, there's no county, there's no school district, no township that can pay for what has to be restored here when there's a disaster.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pawlowski. I know that whenever I ask you a question, I can always get a complete and thorough answer. Thank you.
Representative Wiginian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pawlowski, I understand and appreciate the need for this disaster fund. When we had hearings, our first hearing at the beginning of session in our Climate and Energy Committee, we heard from experts about the impact of climate change on our waters. And one of the things that came up is right now in the southern third of our state, the ground is saturated and the water levels are high. So the potential for flooding is absolutely real. One of the other things that came up is the testifier who talked about the impact of climate change on drinking water. The question was to him was, if we have a flood, do we have the capacity to test all the private wells that may be contaminated with the flood water? And the answer was no. So my question to you is, can this money be used to give good drinking water to people whose wells are flooded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, my answer would be yes. And I'm going to go back to 2007 when we had the original special session bill, and I remember you testifying specifically on that point with what had happened to Rushford, because not only was its sewer system blown away, all of its water wells were also blown away. And you had raised this point in the first hearing, and then you had raised it several times. And subsequent to that, as we were amending the bill, we made sure that we addressed it in the special session bill, and then we also addressed it in Chapter 12A. So to the extent, yes, we can.
Representative Wiginian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rushford itself is a community well.
Yes.
And I know that well had, and we heard testimony just, you know, weeks ago about what happened in Rushford. But I'm talking about private wells, not public wells. And private wells, particularly given the karst area of karst nature of the geology in your area, or in southern third of Minnesota, southeast, private wells can be contaminated even if that land is not flooded. And so the question will be, for private wells, can we help those whose get water to those whose private wells have been contaminated?
Representative McGinnis, I'm going to call in an expert on this, and we'll get a definitive answer for you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Kevin Reed. I'm the Deputy Director for Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And this count is for public infrastructure, so it helps with publicly owned. So the testing of private wells would fall to the Department of Health, and that's where they go. We could help the State Department, but not the owner of that well.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, the question is not so much testing, because we know we don't have the capacity, and I assume my testifier was right, mm-hmm. that we don't have the capacity to test private wells. So if we don't have the capacity and we think wells are likely to be contaminated from a flood, then what's the state's response? How does the state help homeowners, families whose wells are contaminated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so that would fall into our emergency operations plan, and that particular piece would fall to the Department of Health. This fund is not for private citizen, it's for public infrastructure. So we would have to work with and support the Department of Health on that. That is their area, not the Homeland Security area.
Representative Guinea.
Thank you for that testimony. Morning and clarifying that, mm-hmm. but that does tell me that if we are going to have a disaster relief package that works for citizens, we need to address what happens to their drinking water. I mean, that's public health. So I don't know what the procedure would be right now, but we should certainly hear what the plans of the administration are.
Is it Director Reed? Is that
Deputy Director?
Yeah, yep. Director Reed.
Yeah. So Chapter A and Chapter 12A, 12B limit what we can do with this, or spells out exactly what we can do with this. So that is a different. That is something additional. Yes.
Representative Guinea.
But a flood is not going to say we're just flooding public infrastructure. We're flooding private drinking water wells. People can get sick. So it would be good for Homeland Security to work with the Department of Health so we have a response. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Director Reed, comment.
Yes, and it is similar to a private house being flooded during a flood. That's there's an insurance piece, and then when the insurance takes care of that, then we can help with above and beyond. But that individual household would be covered if that person had flood insurance or a rider, a backup rider. So there's some things that this count can't do, but we work with both FEMA and other state agencies to help that individual. There's just there's different levels of what we can and cannot do, and it's very spelled out in 12B on what we can and cannot spend that money on.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pulaski, thank you for your continued diligence and vigilance on this. I do want to pose a question to you. I know that in possibly the Greater Minnesota Committee hearing and subsequent to that, there was information that leads me to believe that there was an underestimation as to the costs for the most recent natural disaster. That quite literally leaves this fund in the negative by the tune of about $3 million. And so to the points that have been raised, particularly with regard to Representative Hertaus, and to your point about no special session is really very special, I'm just wondering if in concert with that and relevant to things costing more, I'm wondering if you might speak to that and also the import for funding this properly in the upcoming weeks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the testimony that we took, and we have Deputy Director Reed here, and he can explain it in more detail, it came from FEMA, actually, and it was an underestimation when they had first looked at what they thought the cost was going to be, and then once they got into it. So I'm going to let Director Reed respond in more detail. But this is sort of similar when you start doing a major home project and you suddenly find out that when you're taking walls out and other things that there are things that you need to replace that you didn't anticipate, and FEMA apparently ran into that about double. So I'll let Deputy Director Reed be specific about it.
Director Reed.
Mr. Chairman. Representative, yeah. So when we had the initial damage assessment is how we first come out. FEMA comes out, worked with us. We had asked for a three-week period. They were able to give us a two-week period. So we came in at about $40 million on the initial damage assessment. As we start to create project worksheets, which is whatever township road, we started to see an increase. And then we ended up somewhere in the $70 million range. That has been addressed with the regional administrator from FEMA and the governor. They had a meeting to discuss that because of how that affects us and the 25%. Moving forward, we are looking at some enhancements for how we do that to try to capture so we don't have to look at the difference in the 25% that the 12 beat it. So we are doing after actions to say, how does this not happen again? But that did happen in this last event.
Any further questions?
No, just a comment, Mr. Chair, that, you know, I know that time is of the essence with regard to a natural disaster, and I certainly empathize with Rushford, but Prior Lake and the Scott County area also suffered one, and that actually drove some of the content and the relationship between Representative the chair of, I'm drawing a blank in terms of my convert, but I just would urge the majority to seriously consider raising the bar on disaster relief. It makes no time for a legislative session. It happens at the most precarious moments in a community's life, and I would urge Mr. Pawlowski, Representative Pawlowski, and those that are advocating for this to push hard on fully funding it as best possible. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we're now 13 years after Rushford, and we have experience with disasters. And I think it's very important to fund the disaster response and to make sure that that is there in the future. But we're also going to have to look at prevention, and that means containment, probably looking at our standards for water containment for facilities on how much, let's say if there's a petroleum tank and it has 150% of containment, we may have to build in design of 200% because we're getting more water. With trees, if there's an ice storm or just the public property of trees coming down, we've had testimony in our committee that there's no place to go with them. We can't landfill them. We can't burn them. They're piling up, literally. And so some of these questions of where do we go with the stuff that's broke or that's flooded or that's moldy or that's being taken down is something we don't discuss on a larger term, and the cost for that, the prevention cost, may help us with this. On the soil conservation side, I think it would be good to maybe look back at some of the structures that we put in after Rushford and see if they're still holding water or if they've been blown out. Water storage, snow melt storage, is going to be right here in the next month. So these are the other part of the disaster. What do we do with the cleanup materials? What do we do with the trees? How do we handle those things? Have to come as a part of the discussion on disasters as we continue to fund that immediate response. So there's the prevention, and then there's the response, and then the reaction. And that, hopefully, if we can engage in that, not in this bill, Representative Pawlowski, but we're going to have that discussion to make sure that we're lasting in the future, because these extreme weather events are going to become more common.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski.
To this point, at the press conference the governor had, which would, I think, be 2 weeks ago tomorrow, this was specifically brought up in the amount of money that he has for a category of protecting our waters, and it was brought up in a private conversation before the press conference that we do indeed need to do everything that you had just mentioned. And if you take a look at the structures in southeastern Minnesota that replace those that were blown away, they're dramatically different. In fact, so dramatically different that I would assume that Representative Davids has also gotten complaints from some of our constituents that we overbuilt. Well, everything is built now to a 500-year flood or incident criteria, and some of our constituents think we're spending too much money on overbuilding. I don't. I think you're exactly right. we have to do something different. And the other issue is, in southeastern Minnesota, one of the areas that was first settled, you had structures that were 100-plus years old when this happened. There was no anticipation of this type of an event with those types of structures.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I appreciate Representative bringing up the issue of prevention. So one of the things that happened at Rushford is it was discovered that there were a whole bunch of unused wells that were draining into the drinking water supply for Rushford, so draining into the groundwater. As you did the prevention in structure, has the prevention in looking for those wells and sealing them around, particularly in your Karst area, has that been done so that we don't run into the Rushford problem again?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guinness, I couldn't answer that question at this time, but I'm sure we can get an answer for it.
I think it's important to do this prevention work too, because otherwise it is so costly.
Costly would be, Mr. Chairman, Representative Venus, yes, costly. We've run into costly.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Pulaski, would you care to renew your motion?
I'm going to renew my motion that House Bill 3633 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Mm-hmm. Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Pulaski. We now have House File, let's see, what's the number, 2490, Representative Nelson. And this will be, by the way, a procedural motion. We're sending it to the state government finance, and then if they act favorably on it, it will be returned to Ways and Means. So, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the, actually it's going to capital.
Or bonding, excuse me.
Capital investment, yeah. But Mr. Chair, I move the state government finance.
You just made me think of state government finance.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that the state government finance division report for House File 2490. I move the division report.
You just simply move it to the capital investment committee.
First, I have to move the report. I'm moving the report
We move the report. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried.
And Mr. Chair.
Now, Representative Nelson.
I move the House File 2490 as amended be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Capital Investment Finance.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Representative Walgamott here to talk about his bill?
I have him available. This is simply a procedural motion, but I asked him to be available if there were any questions. Representative Walgamott.
Mr. Chairman, while we're waiting for the representative to come down, I just want to formally point out that I believe Representative Willie's glasses should be declared as part of a disaster declaration, a fashion disaster declaration. Just want that noted for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking similarly of that suit over there.
Oh, hey. That's...
Albright, shut up. Why are you applauding?
Mr. Chair, it should be obvious.
If we're going to have a discussion on it, we have to have a motion that the bill be before us. I thought you said we needed to have the motion.
The motion is
to refer it.
Well, then we just need question. Yeah. Okay, Representative Druskowski.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Representative Walgamott can talk about his bill and the reason it's here. Why are we going to build skate parks throughout the state with taxpayer dollars?
Well, the intent in Ways and Means is not to have a hearing on the bill. It was in the possession of Ways and Means, and the actual hearing will be in capital investment. And would only come back to us if they favorably act on it. Now, I will entertain a question if you want to know what the bill is about, but The idea is not to debate the bill here this morning. The idea is to get it before the appropriate committee and have a discussion there. If they act on it, then it comes back here. Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Drazkowski. I'm putting this bill forward because I'm a father of two children, and I'm pretty concerned about how kids in our communities are spending too much time on the couch, on the phone, in front of the TV. And so we're putting this bill forward because skate parks are considered to be an effective method for improving youth quality of life in communities. They're safer than being out in the streets where many skaters can will go in the absence of skate parks. Further parks can act as community centers and can preclude young people from engaging in less safe or less desirable activities. They're also great because for kids who maybe don't have parents who can have the structure to give them a ride to practice or give them, you know, have all those structural limitations on a lot of team sports, it's really easy for our youth to access skate parks rather than having to spend a lot of money on all kinds of different equipment like you would for other sports. Skate parks are pretty affordable. You just need a skateboard and you show up. So this is a bill to help kids be active. This is a bill to support our youth. And it's very similar to what we've done with the Mighty Ducks program in hockey. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's what the bill is about, Representative Drazkowski, so you've got a little background on it. But the intent is that we not hear it. That'll have to be capital investment, and that's why the motion.
Mr. Chair, can we talk about how the bill works? So as I understand, just reading it here quickly, it's a bonding bill that borrows 2.5, maybe it's more than that, $8 million, and then appropriates that to, maybe if the author can talk about how the bill works and how this
ends. Drazkowski, I've made it very clear the intent is not to have a hearing on the bill today. It is a re-referral motion. You did appropriately ask what the bill was about. You got that information. So the motion before us will put it before the appropriate committee to have the hearing. If you want to have further discussion, perhaps you can have that offline. We've got a full agenda today, and I do want to move the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Committee. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, to the point of the re-referral, I understand under the rules from the prior session that there were divisional reports that had to come up through Ways and Means, and with the change in the rules with new bills being introduced, they would not necessarily have to go through Ways and Means to be re-referred to a new division. So does this bill fall under the old regime, and that's why it's coming back here?
The first day, I explained we'd kind of have a hybrid, that there were a number of bills that were already in Ways and Means. The best way to look at it is that the bill goes out the way it came in. So this one came in under the old rules. It was in the possession of Ways and Means, and bills that come in this session now are referred directly to a division, and then those reports would go to the floor and then re-referred to Ways and Means if necessary. So we'll have a mixture. That's why we periodically are adopting division reports. And I'm so used to the new system now, I forget sometimes that we need that motion to adopt the division report, which I did just a few minutes ago. Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none then.
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion.
Okay, that it be re-referred without recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We now will go to the next item on the agenda, and that's where we'll be having some discussion, and one of the reasons I wanted to move along. So kind of goes back to what Minority Lead was asking about when we have the budget resolution. I think we've all had some briefings last week on the forecast, but this is an opportunity after you've had a chance to look at it a little bit more thoroughly to hear from MMB. Mm-hmm. And if your team, Commissioner, can give us an update on the forecast, and then we'll take take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Myron France, Commissioner
Minnesota Management and Budget, and thank you for the opportunity to come before Ways and Means and give you some more additional information about the budget forecast that we released last Thursday. As we mentioned, the forecasted balance for fiscal years 20 and 21 is now $1.513 billion. Go here. And that's an increase of $181 million since November. Now, we raised the revenue forecast that Dr. Klumpakidis will talk about by $96 million, which is a 0.2% increase. And we lowered the spending forecast, the Budget Director Brittany Kahn will discuss, by $91 million, which is also about 0.2% decrease. In addition, as you'll note, we'll go through and explain that we raised the stadium reserve projection by $6 million for this biennium. So one of the things that we want to do is provide an opportunity to talk about the budget forecast and the numbers and the rationale behind that, but we also will talk a little bit today about the budget reserve target. You will recall that last November we reached the target of the budget reserve of $2.359 billion. That continues through this forecast. As many of you know, there is no change, automatic change to the forecast in the February, to the reserve in the February forecast. So one of the things that's critical about the maintaining the budget reserve is really similar to the discussion you've already had earlier today about the disaster accounts reserve and also about funding for the RFA loans. And also there's a health contingency question that we're going to have about the ongoing issues that we're facing today. So it's really our recommendation that we maintain this target level. And as you know, the budget reserve was used in the concluding settlement of the budget discussion last session, and $491 million of that budget reserve will be used in fiscal year 22. For general operations will go to the bottom line unless we do something to change that. So we'll be recommending that rainy day fund stay at the current target. So one of the things I also want to mention before I let Dr. Klumpakidis take over is that structural balance continues in this forecast. As you all recall, structural balance occurs when your revenue projections exceed your spending projections within a biennium. So in this forecast, the outlook for the economy remains stable. The budget outlook remains stable, but as always, there are risks, and we're finding that out on a daily basis. Risks change from day to day. So I'll let Dr. Klumpakidis describe how the economic outlook has changed since last December. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Myron. I'm Laura Klumpakidis, state economist. I will start by talking a bit about the outlook for the U.S. economy and how that outlook has changed since we last prepared our forecast in November. Then I'll move to Minnesota's economy and finally to the changes in the revenue forecast. So the first chart, the bar chart, compares current U.S. real GDP growth forecast by our consulting firm IHS to their prior forecast. The dark bars show the history and their February outlook, the one that informs our current forecast, and then the light bars, of course, show their November outlook. If you focus on years 19 to 23, you can see that the outlook for U.S. economic growth changed very little between November and February. Only in 22 is the growth forecast slightly higher than before. And the pattern of slowing growth through the planning horizon carries over from the prior forecast. In their February outlook, IHS expected current economic conditions to support moderate real GDP growth of 2.1% this year. In particular, consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of real GDP. And IHS expects consumers to remain the primary contributors to growth in the economy. In this forecast, consumer spending is supported by rising incomes, falling gas prices, a lower interest rate path than had been in the prior forecast, although in the outlook, interest rates do increase, and rising household wealth. So the wealth story is important here, and that is that when wealth grows, for example, from rising home values and rising financial asset values, consumers tend to spend more. That positive wealth effect has been an important contributor to economic growth during this expansion. But it's at risk if wealth declines or if economic and policy uncertainty make consumers jittery. So if you look at the shortening dark bars for years 21 to 23 on the chart, you can see that a slowdown is still expected, and that was expected to start late next year. Real GDP growth is expected to decelerate from 2% annually in 2021 1.5% in 23. The slowdown occurs as the contribution to growth from federal fiscal stimulus declines. Lingering effects of tariffs and trade policy uncertainty undermine business investment. Interest rates gradually rise, and growth in household wealth slows. So in this outlook, household wealth was expected to grow, but it slows as the years go on. In addition, a decline in the U.S. labor force participation rate due to an aging workforce will further slow the economy. So while there's little change in, there was little change between the November and February forecasts overall, underlying the GDP forecast is lower expected growth in some types of consumer spending. And those lower forecasts in those components bring down our forecast for sales tax revenue. This chart compares Minnesota's labor market performance to the nation's. The chart shows the headline unemployment rate. The dark line is for Minnesota, the light line for U.S., for the U.S. Through the current U.S. Expansion, now in its 11th year, Minnesota has continued to add jobs and sustain a state unemployment rate below the U.S. rate. However, Minnesota's pace of employment growth has slowed, and the gap between the state and national unemployment rates has narrowed. The U.S. unemployment rate is at a 50-year low of 3.5%, while Minnesota's rate has gradually risen since December of 18 to 3.3%. So the increase in Minnesota's rate along with the decline in the U.S. rate has narrowed the gap between the national and state unemployment rates. The increase in Minnesota's unemployment rate coincided with an increase in our labor force participation rate, which is the share of the over 16 population that's either working or looking for work. Our participation rate is consistently above the U.S. and among the highest in the nation. And since December of 18, it inched even higher to 70.3%, which is 7 percentage points above the U.S. rate. So a coincidental uptick in both the labor force participation rate and the unemployment rate means that people entered the labor market, labor force, looking for work but didn't immediately find work. Demand for labor in Minnesota is strong, and we expect that demand to persist as long as the U.S. expansion does. The baby boomer retirements have made it difficult to match that demand with increased labor supply. Job vacancies statewide have grown to a very high level, and for the last 2.5 years, we've had fewer unemployed job seekers than open positions across the state. At the low point of the 07-09 recession, there were nearly 7 unemployed persons for each job opening in Minnesota. In contrast, there are now 7 people for each 10 job openings. And the tight labor market is being felt across Minnesota, as both in the Twin Cities and in greater Minnesota, there are fewer job seekers than open positions. So amid that strong demand for workers, slower labor force growth appears to be limiting the state's ability to add jobs. Between 2011 and 2017, Minnesota added an average of 43,000 jobs per year. In the last 2 years, the annual additions have averaged about half that number. In our forecast, we expect slower employment growth to persist as growth in total wage and salary income in Minnesota will primarily come from higher wages per worker instead of from larger numbers of people employed. I'll move to the revenue forecast and then to the risks. Total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be, as you heard from the commissioner, $96 million, or 0.2% more than the November forecast. Higher expected corporate tax revenue more than offsets lower forecasts for the income and sales taxes. Individual income tax receipts are now forecast to be $51 million less than the November forecast. The decrease is primarily due to lower forecast growth in both total wage and salary income and non-wage income, in particular capital gains. General sales tax revenue in the current biennium is now forecast to be $81 million less than the prior forecast. That change reflects lower forecasts for taxable sales, including some of the components of consumer spending that were lowered in the U.S. outlook. The corporate franchise tax is forecast to generate $217 million more in the current biennium than in the prior forecast. So far in fiscal year 20, gross corporate tax receipts have exceeded our November 19 forecast by $59 million. So that larger amount of collections currently drives an increase in the forecast for corporate tax receipts. Let me conclude by drawing your attention to some of the risks to the forecast that the commissioner also alluded to. I mentioned the risk that consumers, the champions of this economic expansion, get spooked by uncertainty or negative wealth effects. For example, from a prolonged decline in the stock market, and hold on to their wallets. This forecast incorporates all U.S. tariffs and other countries' retaliatory measures that have been put in place to date, as well as the tariff rollbacks in the recent Phase 1 agreement with China. But as you know, U.S. trade policy, especially regarding China, but also regarding our other trading partners, has been in flux. Uncertainty imposes costs on businesses that must address supply chain disruptions. Businesses already appear to have put investment plans on hold, and prolonged uncertainty will exacerbate the slowdown. In their February outlook, which they released on February 6th, IHS expected temporary and modest impacts on the U.S. economy from COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. Their most recent commentary on this, which was released on Friday, adds to that information. So I'll read from their most recent information. The deterioration in financial conditions, unless quickly reversed, threatens to undermine forecasts for personal consumption expenditures and business investment, implying significant downside risks to the forecast for GDP growth. Policymakers in the Federal Open Market Committee are likely to view a single 25 basis point reduction in the federal funds rate as an inadequate response to the burgeoning downside risks to the outlook. So we expect their response to be both rapid and larger than a standard quarter point reduction. We assume there will be a half point rate cut at the upcoming policy meeting, which is in less than 3 weeks. And then they point out later, so that one of the ways that they're altering their expectations now is that now they're pricing in, or they're expecting the Fed to lower the federal funds rate in this month. And then they say, if, as we all hope, there are quick recoveries from the COVID-19 crisis in the sense of health and mortality and in economic terms, then the rate cut could be taken back in a few months or more. For now, we assume that next month's rate cut will be reversed in December. But it's important to stress even more so now than usual that the price timing and even precise timing and even the magnitude of monetary policy actions are subject to change as the situation related to COVID-19 evolves, including its impacts on financial indicators, sentiment, and actual economic activity. And so what we said in our forecast document at the time was that if the impact of the outbreak becomes more prolonged or widespread than it appeared at the time IHS constructed their February outlook, U.S. economic growth would be lower than expected. And some of the channels through which the economic effects of COVID-19 can come are demand for U.S. goods exported to China and other Asian countries, including agricultural commodities, can fall as economic activity slows in that region. U.S. manufacturers that import intermediate goods from Asia must adapt to supply chain disruptions. And U.S. consumers may spend less as uncertainty increases and financial market volatility dampens growth in household wealth. And then finally, with 16 months before the end of the current biennium, even small changes in assumed growth rates, in particularly volatile income sources like corporate profits or capital gains, can materially alter the budget picture through our horizon. I can take questions now, or I can pass it on to Britta.
Why don't we take questions at this point, or at least a couple, three, and then we can hear from the budget director, kind of keep it in the two parts, I think. Are there questions of Dr. Kalambakidis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Kalambakidis. Two questions. How do you understand looking at slide four with the slight uptick in unemployment, but the point you made that more people are entering the labor market, but then not finding jobs, because my impression was, and I think you testified, there are jobs sitting there waiting. Can you help me understand, how do you square that?
Yep.
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, that's right. There are jobs. Open positions are at a very high level. And so, and it means, almost by definition, it means that when you have an increase in the labor force participation rate and an increase in unemployment rate, it means that people entered the market and didn't immediately find jobs. So there needs to be more creative matching between the people who are looking for work and the jobs that are actually available. So there may be mismatches there in geography, for instance, so the jobs are in one area and the people looking for work are somewhere else. There can be mismatches in wages. So the people enter the labor market, start looking for work, but the wage that they're looking for is lower than what businesses are offering right now. There could be mismatches in occupations, for instance. So that you're right that that's it, having very high job vacancies doesn't necessarily mean that everyone who's looking for work can find precisely the job they want. And so there can still be people who continue to look for work while they're looking for the right thing in the right place.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. And Dr. Kalamakidis, thank you for that. It certainly fuel for thought. It's an interesting challenge to have. You also spoke to possible Fed response to the coronavirus, and I think many of us have the apprehension that the Trump administration has used a lot of the tools for economic stimulus without our seeing an economic stimulus. The Job and Tax Act primarily went to the wealthy and didn't, you know, the economic growth is well below the promised levels of 4% annually. The interest rates are at record lows, near record lows is always the safe comment. And if the Fed actually does a 0.5% rate cut, I'm going to guess that's record lows and leaves us less tools in the toolbox, to be trite, when we actually do see experience a recession. Am I the only one concerned?
Yeah. Dr. Kalamakidis?
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee. So a couple points on that. One, I don't have my GDP chart doesn't go, oh yeah, it does go to 18. So the growth that you see in 2018, which was above trend growth, that 2.9%, that was fueled by federal economic stimulus. That was deficit-financed economic stimulus. So that means that the federal government can spend money and increase the deficit and increase debt and can create some economic stimulus. That's not something the state has the opportunity to do because the state has to balance its budget and can't run deficit spending. But there was an increase in growth in 2018 that is attributable to the fiscal stimulus that took place in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The other point about the tools in the toolbox, that has been a concern, I agree with you, for almost the entirety of this economic expansion, is that interest rates have been very low, and so there is not a lot of room for the Fed to, that lever is like at, it can't go a whole lot lower. So that's been a concern throughout this economic expansion, that the monetary policy tool, which has been the primary tool for supporting the economy during this record length expansion, it doesn't have a lot of power in it because interest rates have been so low. And so is there more opportunity for, so if the U.S. economy goes into recession, we don't have as much opportunity to address that with monetary policy as we might have had interest rates been higher for longer. Regarding fiscal policy, the federal government can deficit finance. We do have a very high debt to GDP ratio now, and so that event at some point that does limit the ability of the federal government to deficit finance fiscal stimulus. But that remains a tool that's possible.
Right. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got two people on the list, and then I have a question, and we'll recognize those two, and then we'll go to. Budget Director Raton to complete the presentation. When we had the briefing, I asked the question, and it's down here under the forecast risks about the virus outbreak. And since we had the briefing following things on the news, there's been a lot happening. And especially over the weekend, I found out this morning, Representative Pawlowski pointed out that, for example, Minnesota State has now banned travel, and we are a tourism state, not that that's driving our tourism, but there's a lot of concern about travel by air and the close confinement, and so what that might have an impact. You know, Mall of America is our number one tourist attraction, and a lot of people fly in for purchases there. And then on the news, they were talking about, this surprised me, most of our pharmaceuticals are coming out of China, and that there's some potential problems there. They were advising people to get your prescriptions filled early. That probably takes some cooperation with your doctor to authorize it, or the insurance company, if you're going to get additional pharmaceuticals for your needs coming up. On the news this morning, they showed that over the weekend, our stores were being emptied out. I think it was Costco that they showed a picture of not a single loaf of bread left. So there is a bit of a panic out there, if you will. People are buying supplies, but they're told to buy supplies. So I just wonder if you have any further comments than what you shared with me last, what was it, Thursday or Friday, or whenever the forecast came out. Things seem to be building rather rapidly in terms of the overall concerns about the pandemic.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, of course, at the time that we were presenting the forecast, we knew that conditions were changing quickly and that there was uncertainty about the health effects of this disease, how it's going to spread, and what the economic impact will be. And so I think it's the only reasonable thing to assume is that it's going to continue, the conditions are going to continue to change rapidly, and the risks are going to change as time goes on. And so we are all going to be, in making decisions, we're going to be assuming some risk. I'm sure there are companies in Minnesota that are seeing effects already in terms of supply chain. Manufacturers of transportation equipment, manufacturers of chemicals, they both have intermediate goods that come from China, and so they may already be seeing supply chain disruption. There may be some consumer spending effects happening already. And so, you know, we always exercise caution when we present the forecast. We always tell you that conditions will change, so I just double down on that statement today.
And Dr. Kalamakidis, when would you get an update in terms of how these changes are impacting on the national economy and on the state of Minnesota? I know you get a periodic update.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so we get an updated U.S. economic outlook from IHS every month. It arrives around the 6th or 7th of the month. And then we report quarterly on those economic updates. So just as a matter of course, our normal production schedule is that we would report on the April 10th, we would release our quarterly update that would update you all, everyone, on the U.S. outlook and how that has changed, and the revenue outlook, and or not the revenue outlook, but actual receipts and how those have changed. Now, to be clear, the impact on tax receipts is something that will come at a significant lag to economic effects, and so we'll make that clear at the time that we update on receipts.
Okay, thank you. Now, I did have very early two people. I don't know if your questions were of Dr. Kalamakidis or overall Representative Vogel, and then Albright, you had your hands up early. Are they of Kalamakidis? Okay, Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Doctor. As I read through this, it read much like November, and yet things are drastically different. So I'm wondering, what is your relative degree of confidence in this forecast, since, you know, there's been proposals for a bunch of new spending, for a bunch of new bonding, that we're going to have to make payments out of this money. Are you confident in this forecast, recognizing that you can't always be totally confident, but obviously November things were moving along, and now all of a sudden it's like we've had this black swan appear, and I'm curious where we go from here. So
Dr. Kalamakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee. So I am I'm quite confident about the revenue forecast given the assumptions of the February U.S. economic outlook and given the information that from Minnesota that we had at the time that we put together our forecast. But things always change between the time that we release our forecast or even finalize the numbers and, you know, and today, for instance. Things have changed more rapidly and changed more drastically than they normally do. So I'm confident that we did, you know, we produced a good forecast given the information that we had at the time. But I'm also confident that things have changed quickly, and I will not be surprised if the next economic outlook from IHS shows a different picture than what they gave us in February.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Walgo.
Well, and you know, I looked this morning, and it appears to me that the first big flight to quality came back in January 21st. That's when the 10-year started to drop like 30 basis points over the course of a week or whatever. So I'm just curious, because this is a big document to us. This is the document that's going to drive the decisions on what's going to get spent. What type of conversation was there with the Council of Economic Advisors or those people that had this information between that middle part of January and when the actual forecast was written? Because this is probably one of the most difficult ones to write, but it is going to drive certain things. You know, and these are this is the information we now have. So I'm curious how that's taken into account, because you'll never be 100% accurate, but you also have to have something that you can rely on if you're going to use these numbers to forecast spending.
Dr. Colomakidis.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, you're right that the flight to safety began before IHS released their February 6th outlook. And so in their February 6th outlook, they acknowledged that, and they did make some changes in their outlook for the changes in the stock market that had occurred at that point. And so they lowered, for instance, the path of household wealth growth, and they lowered their path of Treasury yields. But at that same time, they did not incorporate into their outlook significant economic disruption from the COVID-19 outbreak. And so they did not go further than what the financial market information was saying at the time. The Council of Economic Advisors reviewed it at the time again and had a conversation about the COVID-19 outbreak, and it appeared to them that what IHS was saying was that there are risks to this forecast, but that at the moment it looked like the likely economic impact was going to be temporary. And so that was the conversation and the information that we had at the time that we started constructing the numbers for our forecast. I agree that there is a lot of risk to this forecast. And so when we produce a forecast, we do the best we can with the information we have, and then we are as clear as we possibly can be about what the risks are. So what the risks are that the policymakers are taking on when they make these decisions. So I was in a risky position in producing the forecast. I was in a risky position releasing it, and now you're in a risky position in making decisions based on it.
Mr. Chair, just one.
Yeah, I want to get through the people that are on the list, and then I wanted to get to Director Raton. So if you could just maybe have one more question,
yep.
Representative Vogel, so I can honor Representative Albright and Druskowski.
Relative to the prior discussion we had here on the monetary policy flexibility that exists, just curious from the Dr. Klumbakidis, this is a supply chain deficiency. This isn't a normal thing that we have faced. Is it your feeling that monetary policy can even help with something like this? Because you can lower rates as long as you want, but if you don't have the things to manufacture and the people to be able to buy them, the monetary policy becomes really ineffective. And I think this is a little different scenario than what we've had in the past with a typical recession. Would that be true?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's no doubt that this is an unusual circumstance. U.S. manufacturers were facing supply chain disruption even before the COVID-19 outbreak became an issue, because of the trade war between the U.S. and China, and trade policy uncertainty between the U.S. and a lot of other trading partners. So, you know, manufacturers who import intermediate goods from other countries and then try to export them to other countries just can't seem to cut a break because they were facing these disruptions before, and now this is an added something added on. Is monetary policy potentially inadequate? What monetary policy is going to try to do is try to boost confidence and potentially boost consumer spending and potentially boost business investment. And is it going to be enough? Well, we've already discussed the fact that with interest rates as low as they are, the Fed doesn't have that much of a lever right now. So I think it is legitimate to be concerned about the limitations of federal policy in an ability, the ability to turn this thing around.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Good morning, Doctor. On your first slide, I note in the outlying years 22 and 23 specifically, that that is, in economic terms, a very dramatic downturn for the forecast. And I'm just wondering if you could expound a little more deeply on the what, you know, the why, what, and how of why IHS and your concurrence with those metrics is such a dramatic switch from 21.
Dr. Kolmikidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, this is a significant slowdown, and it is something that we have had in the forecast for quite a while now. So we have seen this step down, this slowdown in growth for a while, and the reasons haven't changed. So there is an expectation that, and again, this is a caveated with, these are the assumptions that IHS was making at the beginning of February, that the Fed would hold policy steady until the middle of next year, and then in the middle of next year start on a tightening path and start raising interest rates for 100 basis points over 2 years. And that was one of the things that slows the economy down at that point. Another thing that they put into their forecast either this year or next year was a specific acknowledgement or changing of the factor in regarding labor force participation and the aging of the workforce. So they've known for a long time that the workforce is aging, but they've actually put a trigger in their model, and that slows the growth. They, while in their February outlook, they expected household wealth to grow, they did not expect household wealth to grow at the pace that it has been. So they expected household wealth growth to slow down. And those are all things that that slow this outlook. Now, in the long term, for a long time, it's been expected that U.S. growth would slow in these years. And those reasons, CBO projected it a long time ago, and the reasons were because of the baby boom generation retiring, one, and two, because the debt to GDP ratio for the U.S. has gotten large enough to look like it could be a drag.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up to that. Then on page 5, I note the dichotomy between a reduction in both individual and general sales tax, but then you're forecasting in a very sizable increase in the corporate franchise tax. And to me, that seems awkward or a bit of an outlier. And if you could speak to that in the construct of the national economic picture, what risks do you place on that really coming to fruition?
Dr. Kolmikidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the changes in the individual income tax and the general sales tax really don't have much to do with the change in the corporate tax. So those are moving in different directions and for different reasons. So the income tax forecast has been lowered. Income tax is still projected to grow, but it's a lower forecast than we had in November, and that's because we lowered our expected growth in several income types. The sales tax is a pretty straightforward story. That was a slower growth than we had in November in some types of consumer spending that Minnesota taxes. So as you know, when we construct the sales tax forecast, we look at the projected growth rates in lots of different line items, the types of consumer spending, and we construct Minnesota's tax base from that and see how that grows. And so some consumer spending types went, the forecast went down, and so that's why the sales tax forecast went down. Also note that this is for the current biennium, and so it's none of these numbers are affected by the out year slowdown in 22 and 23. The corporate forecast is constructed from our experience in corporate receipts, so how much corporate receipts have been coming in, and then that changes the base of where we start our forecast, and then it's forecasted off of a U.S. forecast for corporate profits. But the corporate profits forecast didn't change much between November and February. And so that's not the reason for this. The reason that the corporate tax forecast changed is because Minnesota has been receiving more corporate receipts since the last time we released a forecast than we had expected. And so that raised this outlook.
If I might, Mr. Chair, and to that point, Doctor, when you said higher than normal corporate receipts, is it an anomaly? I mean, have you taken a look at what is driving that? Is it just the success of the economy, or is it in particular an industry, you know, sector in the Minnesota economy that's driving that? What deep dive have you done that would explain that anomaly?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, we have no way of knowing which industries are sending in the money. We just look at the evidence we have on receipts. So we don't know from corporate receipts who's sending the money in and what industry it is. We suspect that the deep dive that we've done has been on looking at timing of receipts and behavior of corporations since the big federal law change. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act significantly changed federal tax policy toward corporations, and corporations have altered how they're sending in receipts and the timing of receipts, and it seems to have changed how they're sending in receipts to the states. And so we've done everything we can with the information we have to make sure that we're not forecasting something that is just a temporary timing change, and that won't, you know, that will, you know, they've sent us more money and then we're gonna end up giving it back in refunds. We've tried not to forecast that. And so some of the receipts that we have come in ahead of forecast, we think are going to persist, and that's why we raised the outlook. We had lowered the outlook in November, again, based on some of this uncertainty regarding corporate receipts, and now we've brought it back up.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Kalambakidis, if you would characterize the economy we have from the discussions that you've had with IHS and your professional outlook, and if 100 is the strongest economy we could ever have and zero is dead, what's the number you'd give it?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, of course I deal in numbers, but it would take me a while to come up with an answer to that specific question. The U.S., you're asking about the U.S. economy or Minnesota? U.S. economy? The U.S. economy has been remarkably resilient. This is the longest economic expansion on record. And setting aside, so before the COVID-19 outbreak, this economy has continued to grow, albeit at slower paces, has continued to grow through remarkable uncertainty and risk. International risk, threats to global growth, international events, U.S. political uncertainty, U.S. policy uncertainty. And so we know that even before the disease outbreak, we knew that this economy had been remarkably resilient and that we were sort of on borrowed time. So it's the longest expansion on record. It's been a relatively low growth economy, but it has continued to go. As I said, consumers are the champions of this economy, and they have appeared to be relatively resilient to tremendous risk. And so we've known that a mature, slow growth economy is vulnerable to downside risk. And so this economy has appeared to be resilient to some downside risk, but an exogenous downside risk like a disease outbreak is the kind of thing that can really can cause that growth to finally stop. But it's been surprising how resilient it has been. And prior to the disease outbreak, the fundamentals in the U.S. economy were good, which is why the forecast reads not much different than it was in November, because the economic fundamentals have remained good. The U.S. is continuing to add jobs. U.S. unemployment rate is low. Wealth and income have continued to grow.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We want to hear from Director Durant.
Certainly. This would just be a short question, too, as the last was, Mr. Chair. So thank you, Dr. Kolomakidis. If you could get us that number, that would be awesome. Also wondering if you could contrast in numbers what the per capita household income growth is in Minnesota today versus 4 years ago.
Mr. Chair,
Dr. Kolomakidis,
representative members of the committee, I'll get back to you on that. I may have it in the book, but rather than take up time looking it up, I'll get back to you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Director Raton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Britta Raton, State Budget Director with MMB. We'll move to the expenditure side of the forecast. So the expenditure side of the forecast shows a relatively small amount of change since the November estimate. The overall reduction in spending is $91 million, which is just a 0.2% change compared to the prior estimates. Spending in E-12 education is the biggest driver of the change, with spending projections $99 million below the November estimates. This change is largely due to a reduction in student projections from the previous estimates. Final data from the 18-19 school year was reported in December, and these numbers came in below our prior projections by 0.3%. So total student numbers are still growing year over year. It's just the pace of the growth was somewhat slower than we had previously anticipated. This change in student counts resulted in $56 million reduction in the basic aid formula in the current biennium. Additionally, compensatory aid projections are also lower when compared to the previous forecast by $8 million, and this is due to a reduction in the number of students qualifying for free and reduced lunch when compared to previous estimates. Additionally, there's a $29 million reduction in the special education spending estimates. This is due to both the lower student counts and a slower projected growth rate in actual expenditures for special education. So the growth that occurred in the last school year was just slightly below what we were anticipating, and that lowered the forecast in terms of the size of the growth rate going forward. But it is still growing. And these changes in the changes in the other areas of the expenditure forecast slightly offset the changes in E-12 education, but they're relatively negligible compared to the November estimates. So moving to the next slide, this brings together the overall picture for fiscal years 20 and 21. The slide compares the November forecast estimate with the February forecast estimate. And at the bottom of the first column, you can see the budgetary balance we were projecting in November, which is $1.332 billion. The projected balance has grown with this forecast by $181 million to $1.513 billion. Again, the $181 million change is due to a relatively small increase in the revenue projections of the $96 million that Dr. Kolomakidis talked about, and a decrease in the spending projections of $91 million. The overall change also includes an additional $6 million that is allocated to the stadium reserve. It's also important to note that a large portion of the budgetary balance in fiscal years 20 and 21 is actually due to dollars that are carrying forward from the previous biennium, from the 18-19 biennium. About $1.1 billion of the projected balance of $1.513 billion in this biennium is due to those funds carrying forward from the prior biennium. And that will be clearer as we go to the next slide. So this slide provides another way to look at the impact of the carry forward from fiscal years 18-19 into 2021. What the slide is showing is structural balance in both the 2021 biennium and the 22-23 biennium. which means that we're just comparing the revenues in that biennium, the revenues collected within that biennium, to the spending within that biennium, and that excludes the impact of carry forwards or contributions to the reserves. So current projections do show structural balance in both biennia, with revenue projections exceeding spending projections by $379 million in fiscal years 20 and 21. That $379 million structural balance number shows the amount of the budgetary balance that is actually due to revenues exceeding expenditure projections in this biennium. The remainder of the $1.513 billion, so more than $1.1 billion, of the balance in the current biennium is again due to that carry forward from the previous biennium. It's also important to note with this forecast that we continue to project a structural balance in fiscal years 22 and 23, with revenues exceeding expenditures by $465 million. And this chart also shows the annualized rate of growth in revenues compared to expenditures in 22-23, with the annual rate of growth in revenues projected to exceed spending by 0.1% annually. At the bottom of this slide, we also include an estimate of inflation for fiscal years 22 and 23. And this is to give it a sense of the cost pressures that exist in the planning years. So inflation is generally not included in the expenditure estimates in the forecast for years that we have not already set the budget for. The only places where inflation is incorporated is in forecast programs where there is an inflationary component to the formula, or where the formula is based on actual costs. So examples include property tax refunds, special education payments, a portion of health care payments, and debt service. So the $1.119 billion number that's shown as an inflationary pressure on the slide is an estimate of inflation with a CPI level of inflation applied to those programs that don't already have some inflationary factor built in. So turning to the next slide, this slide shows the changes in the reserves that are currently projected in FY22 and 23. Commissioner Franz mentioned earlier that in the current biennium, our budget reserve is at the target of $2.359 billion, which is reflected in the first column on the slide. You can also see that the budget reserve declines in fiscal year 22-23 by $491 million. And this change is due to a law that was passed last session that reduces the reserve by $491 million at the start of fiscal year 22. This was done to ensure that the planning estimates in 22-23 were balanced as of the end of session. So even though we are at the target reserve level now, the reserve balance is scheduled to be reduced at the beginning of the next biennium. The stadium reserve line is also shown here, and it shows the reserve is projected to grow from $130 million in FY 2021 to $263 million by the end of fiscal year 23. This growth of $133 million is due to continued increases in projected gambling revenues, along with the fact that in FY 21, the state begins retaining sales tax from the city of Minneapolis to cover payments that the state remits on their behalf for stadium expenses. So revenues to the stadium reserve increase at that time by approximately $17 million per year. Now I can answer questions or hand it back to Commissioner Franz.
I want to get to LBO, and we might run a little bit over. I found out that the room is available, but I don't want to run over that much if we can possibly make it, but I do want to get through the LBO. Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Pulaski. Chair. Mr. Tonk, I'd like to go back to slide 7. I note that higher education isn't listed specifically there. Is it lumped into other?
Representative, Mr. Chair, it is lumped into other. So that what we break out are those areas of the budget that are forecast. So higher education spending is not something we forecast because the dollar amounts are appropriated clearly in law. There's not a formula that drives change in the dollar amounts with the forecast.
Mr. Chair, I bring it up because we've seen the MinState system combine 5 campuses up north. We've seen also retrenching in at least one of the major campuses, and now we are looking at a projection of retrenchment of faculty maybe across the system due to declining enrollment. I understand the way we fund this, which is tuition, and student debt. Those are the two primary ways we fund this. But I would say that we may have a problem in higher education with its budgets, particularly coming up in the next fiscal cycle. So just to beware.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had some questions on page 4, slide 7. That's not right. Slide 8, on the stadium reserve. And according to statute, what do we do with that money? Or is, I'm assuming it's outlined there. And then if you know the answer to this, and maybe you don't, but with the recent news stories of, I believe it's a $40 million fix to the stadium, are the taxpayers on the hook for that out of the stadium reserve fund, or is that the responsibility of the owners of the team? Thank you.
And maybe we can have a brief answer on that, because next Monday we've scheduled a hearing specifically on the stadium reserve. But just if you could just give a quick recap, and then anything further we can deal with next Monday.
You bet, Mr. Chair and Representative. First of all, I would refer you to the Office of Legislative Auditor report that was issued in November regarding the stadium reserve, where the OLA reviewed MMB's practice of the legal and financial practices and found that we complied completely with all legal and financial requirements regarding the treatment of the funds, the handling of the funds, the paying out of the funds. So the amount of money that can come out of the reserve is given some discretion to the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, but it relates to stadium uses such as retiring the debt or also supporting operations of the facility itself. So those. But as you should know, that the statute requires any payment of the reserve to be after advice from the legislature before any payment can be made. So that's something for the future we can talk about next Monday too. But also the in terms of the settlement that you heard about regarding the mediation, I really should say, regarding all the construction folks that put together the facility, that money came out of leftover construction funds, money that was left over at the end of the construction cycle. There is no new taxpayer dollars at all going into that settlement agreement to redo and enhance the outside of the stadium. As you know, the concern was the system was originally designed to be a sort of a wet system, allowing some moisture to come in and be routed out of the building, but now they've discovered that a better system would be to have no water come in whatsoever and fully repel all the water. So that's what the skin is going to be. They're going to take off the skin, replace it, to put on this new structure. So the good news is that after the next 2 years, we'll have a brand new exterior that I think will meet the expectations much better, and it will be out of the funds that were left over by. So the construction people who were involved in constructing the facility, the architects, the builders, that the money comes out of funds left over at the construction of the stadium to be used for those amounts. And there's no additional taxpayer dollars going into the stadium whatsoever regarding this. But we can talk more about that too on Monday.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up question. So the funds that were left over, did the legislature lay out what we're supposed to be done with the leftover funds, or has that just been sitting there waiting for something to spend the money on?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, in part, this dispute about the skin or the exterior of the stadium, and there were a number of issues resolving, as you might expect in the construction of a large facility. There were a number of issues that became apparent at the end of the construction cycle. All of those issues have been kind of collecting, and there's been an ongoing, the mediation's been going on, I think, for several years. So it was noted pretty quickly that there was going to be some dispute about how to solve some of these issues that came up during the. Remember, this was a design and construct building, so the company that designed and built it were responsible ultimately for making sure that it works the way it's supposed to. So those monies, I don't have the particular language in front of me about what those were anticipated to be used for, but I can look at that before the hearing next Monday.
Okay, thank you. And just very quickly, and then we're going to go to the LBO. That $491 million, just quick, how do we handle that? I mean, it's a large sum of money, the beginning of the next biennium in terms of how we plan for it. If you've got some thoughts on that, and I don't know if we have to transfer it. I've heard two different scenarios, one that we have to transfer it right away, and that we would have some time at the beginning of the next biennium, or others would. I'm not going to be here, obviously, but,
well, Mr. Chair,
but I'm interested.
Budget Director Ray Tani, we have a very specific way we think it should be handled.
Mr. Chair and members, in law, the $491 million is taken from the reserve at the beginning of fiscal year 22. So that would happen in July of calendar year 21. Essentially, it's just shown on our tracking documents and fund balance as that money being reduced from the overall budget reserve line, and that it then falls to the bottom line to be available in the general fund. So we reduce it at the beginning of fiscal year 22.
So nothing, no action needs to be taken this biennium then?
So in order to not have that happen, in order to maintain the reserve, action would need to be taken to essentially buy it back to leave it in the reserve.
Mr. Chair, I would also, we'll be talking with credit rating agencies, and they've noted that we've, in essence, taken the rainy day fund to fund ongoing operations beginning in fiscal year 22. So it would be our recommendation that we take that money this session and make sure, and then replace that 491 hit to the reserve, so we don't have to do that in 2022.
When I say no action, if I'm understanding this correctly, then we would have to make sure we've left enough money on the bottom line to carry forward to pay the 491, right? Am I mistaken in that, Director Rutan?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, if we don't take action to remove the language from law that takes it out of the reserve, it will still come out of the reserve in 2021, even if there is enough money on the bottom line to continue current spending. So there needs, in order for it not to occur, there needs to be action taken to eliminate that provision in law.
And so that question, I guess, so I'm clear, do we do that this biennium or the beginning of the next biennium is what I'm...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we recommend we do it this session so that so we eliminate that future possibility, so that it's clear that that language is removed and the $491 million does not come out of the reserve, and we have that money is available on the bottom line to be used in the current assets that we have. So given the surplus that we have for this year, we recommend taking action this year to avoid that happening.
Well, that's my point, Commissioner. Then we have to make sure the 491 is there when we're dealing with targets and spending and so on to be available to do that.
Exactly.
But the only action then really that has to take place is to make sure that the 491 remains available. Is that a way to frame it?
Mr. Chair, and
I've heard that it comes out and then it goes back in
so
under current law, but. We can talk more about this,
yes.
Perhaps, just how we handle it, because it is a big number. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair. And so am I to understand that the 491, just to follow up on Chair Carlson, so right now it's being carried on the ledger as an IOU, and if it is not paid back before the end of the fiscal year, it literally could be a detriment to our bond rating?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Franz.
So right now, what will happen if we don't change the language is that July 1, 2021, the 491 will be, or thereabouts, will be taken out of the reserve and taken to the bottom line and available for whatever spending we have. The as you all know, the rainy day fund or the reserve, the budget reserve, is set up to be used in an economic downturn, and we used it last year to close a budget deal that was not the result of an economic downturn. So it is our recommendation that that money be returned to the language be passed so that that money is not taken out of the reserve and it stays there and stays at its target level to be available in the event of an economic downturn. So our recommendation is that the monies not be taken out of the reserve in 2021, but that they stay there, and we use the current reserve balance we have to make pay for that $491 million at this time.
Okay, I think we're going to have more discussion on that later. Representative Albright, is that Somebody get the LBO.
Well, I think it clarifies, thank you, Mr. Chair, I think it clarifies the question, and I think what it further exacerbates to the conversation the last time that we had these folks before our committee is that we did not live within our means, and I think it shows that we don't have structural balance. We actually do have a structural deficit to the point that we've got to repay it back before we enter into the next biennium. So I'll leave my comments at that and look forward to Monday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll now go to LBO. It's the Legislative Budget Office, and this is the new process. Bill carried on the House side by Representative Vogel, creating a new agency within the legislature to do fiscal notes. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
The main thing is so people understand the current status of the, I don't know if I should call it an agency. It's really not an agency as such. It's I'll let you define it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Michelle Weber, and I am the director of the Legislative Budget Office. Just taking a moment to, there we go. Thank you very much, and I will be as efficient with time as I can be here. I wanted to thank you again for the opportunity to share an overview of the LBO. I'll provide a little bit of history of the office, share some statistics with you, talk a little bit about what's the same and what's changing as a result of the creation of the LBO, and then take a few minutes to introduce you to the team that's here with me today. The Legislative Budget Office was initially created in law in the 2017 session. That law included some base funding for the office. It also included that base funding would support 6.5 staff within the office. It created a transition task force and initially had an effective date for the office to assume responsibility for fiscal notes on January 8th of 2019. In the 2018 legislative session, there were changes to the LBO statute that delayed the implementation date from January 8th, 2019 to September 1st of 2019 to allow for the first year that the LBO has responsibility for the oversight of fiscal notes to be in a non-budget year when the volume and quantity is a little bit less than in, quite a bit less actually in than it is in the budget year. It also created an oversight commission, an 8-member oversight commission that the Legislative Budget Office reports to. It created an appointment for the director, a 6-year appointment, and I'm in the second year of that that initial appointment. And then in 2019, there were additional funds that were made available for the operations of the Legislative Budget Office to increase the initial staffing estimate of 6.5 full-time equivalents up to 12. One other change that I'll note that was pretty significant between the 2017 and 2018 law was initially the Legislative Budget Office was charged with preparing fiscal notes. In 2018, that was changed to have the Legislative Budget Office responsible for the overall coordination and oversight of the fiscal note process, but continued to rely on underlying agency expertise for the preparation of the fiscal note. This slide shows a bit about our operating budget. As I mentioned, there was an increase in the 2019 session to allow us to staff up to 12 individuals. The Legislative Budget Office operating budget primarily supports staff, a contract with Minnesota Management and Budget for the fiscal note tracking system, which is the technology system that's used to manage the workflow and production of fiscal notes. And then also there are some dollars that are intended for some offsite, potential offsite space if the office were to move to the 525 Park building when the revisor's office moves back into the state office building. During the first year that I've been in this position, we've been focused on preparing for the transition of the oversight now that we're well into several months into. It feels like several months. I guess it's a little less than 1 month into session. One of the first things that we had to do was enter into an agreement with Minnesota Management and Budget
for operational control of the fiscal note tracking system. So we didn't develop a new technology system to manage the workflow and production of fiscal notes. Rather, we're contracting with Minnesota Management and Budget and continuing to use that system. We also secured temporary space in the basement of this building for the office to be located in. We developed uniform standards and procedures that govern the fiscal note process. And as part of developing those standards and procedures, we conducted two surveys last spring, as well as a series of focus groups over the summer that included nonpartisan fiscal staff, committee administrators, research staff, agency fiscal note coordinators, and the MMB budget division, as well as chief financial officers at agencies to provide input into the standards and procedures, which were approved by the Oversight Commission and made available on September 1st last year to be timed at the same time as the oversight responsibilities took effect for the Legislative Budget Office. We've developed a user guide for those directly involved in the fiscal note process, as well as operational protocols. We've been meeting with chairs and agencies to understand the fiscal note process. We've also been meeting with minority leads of committees and building relationship with committee administrators and fiscal staff. The staff within the Legislative Budget Office all began between the periods of January last year and October of last year. And to prepare for, to develop a level of expertise and the analytical capabilities to review agency-provided fiscal notes, they have conducted a review of all fiscal notes in their policy areas from the last couple of years of the legislative session. They also did case studies on fiscal notes that were flagged for us during last year's session of things that were particularly complicated or could have benefited from additional time, as well as done research projects on topics that are of high interest in their policy areas. Things that are the same that haven't changed as a result of the Legislative Budget Office taking over responsibility for the oversight of fiscal notes, the fiscal analysts for the committees continue to request the fiscal notes, and they are the individuals who receive the completed fiscal note once the LBO has signed off on them. The underlying assumptions and data used in the preparation of the fiscal note is prepared by the agencies who are responsible for the implementation of the proposed legislation. I already mentioned that we're continuing to use the same technology system, and the format of fiscal notes has not changed. Also, in the development of our uniform standards and procedures, I mentioned focus groups and gathering input, but we also used the longstanding policies and procedures that had been in place as a foundation to build those uniform standards and procedures. And then we work closely with fiscal analysts and committee administrators to understand what the priorities are for the committee. At certain points in time, the quantity of requests exceeds both the capacity of agencies as well as the capacity of the LBO to turn all those requests around in a short period of time. And so we work closely with the fiscal analysts to make sure we're meeting the committee needs and priorities. Things that are new, rather than the request going to Minnesota Management Budget, it comes to the Legislative Budget Office, and we review the legislation and determine which agency should be assigned to prepare a fiscal note. We also analyze the information once the agency submit it for reasonableness, accuracy, and objectivity. And for fiscal notes that involve more than one agency, what we call consolidated notes, we work with agencies to make sure that assumptions are aligned. In the fiscal note tracking system, a new role has been created for the Minnesota Management and Budget Executive Budget Officer. For fiscal notes that are not classified, regular fiscal notes, the Executive Budget Officer will receive a notification when the Legislative Budget Office has made an assignment of a fiscal note to an agency. And when the agencies complete those notes, the preliminary data is also available to MMB so that we can have conversations or flag any tracking issues that might be identified.
Ms. Weber, we're down to a little less than 50% of the committee because we're running over a little bit. If necessary, we can have you come back, but you do have staff here for introductions. So why don't we jump to that so people know who's doing what?
That sounds great.
And they can look this over, and then if members have some additional questions. I just wanted people to be aware that there's a new process, and who some of the players are, and as was pointed out, the big change is that we no longer go through MMB, we go through the budget office, and you deal with the state agencies, I think, in a nutshell. So if you could do the introductions, if you don't mind, it's just that we're at about 50%, maybe not even quite that.
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chair. This slide that I have before you shows the policy assignments, and the first two individuals who will be coming down are Jim Carlson and Catherine Hull.
Welcome, and if you could just identify yourself and maybe tell what area that you work in, maybe a little bit about your background.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Jim Carlson. I am the analyst in the LBO with the assignment area of agriculture, education, or not education, environment and housing. I worked at the Minnesota Department of Revenue for 11 years and was involved with preparing fiscal notes at Revenue.
And you have a good last name. Good Minnesota last name.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Catherine Ho. I'm the coordinator for the Legislative Budget Office. I provide support to the fiscal note tracking system users and also to the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission. I'm the coordinator for the local impact notes, and I also am the analyst to review MNSURE fiscal notes. And I also came from the Department of Revenue, where I was a management analyst.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move rather rapidly.
Mr. Chair, the next two individuals who are coming down are Christian Larson and Alyssa Holderman.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Christian Larson. I'm working with the Economic Development Policy Area. Before coming to the LBO, I worked with the Missouri Department of Economic Development doing economic and labor market research. And I also spent some time at two different universities doing budget analysis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Alyssa Holterman. I'm an analyst with the Legislative Budget Office. I cover the areas of E through 12 education, higher education, and then a portion of state government, including the legislature, the Department of Administration, and Military and Veterans Affairs. Before I came to the LBO, I spent about 2.5 years at the Department of Education working on the school nutrition team.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Steve McDaniel and Carlos Huerica, the remaining members of our Health and Human Services team, are coming to the table.
Are you up to full speed?
We have one vacancy that we did not fill yet, and so we did hire a temporary staff person to work with us during the session. That's also helping us.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Steve McDaniel. I'm one of the analysts in the Health and Human Services policy area, focusing on healthcare administration, continuing care for older adults, and community supports administration at DHS. Prior to joining the LBO, I spent 5 years as an auditor for the state auditor's office, 2 years as an auditor for the city of Bloomington, and 2 years as a senior internal auditor for the city of Minneapolis. And most recently, I spent 1 year as a budget analyst at a nonprofit in the health and human services area.
Chair members, my name is Carlos Huerica. I'm an LBO analyst, also overseeing fiscal notes for health and human services, as well as the health licensing boards. So my divisions within DHS include direct care and treatment, administration, families and children. And prior to coming to the LBO, I was working for a local nonprofit in Minnesota, or in Minneapolis, called Centro Tyrone Guzman. Prior to that, I finished my master's in public policy and public health at the University of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
And just two more groups, Mr. Chair, Maren Bardal and Adam Blom.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Maren Bartle. I'm an analyst with the LBO working on notes assigned to corrections, sentencing guidelines, and public defense board. I'm a licensed attorney with prior experience in criminal defense, and I previously worked for the Legislative Commission on Data Practices as a nonpartisan researcher.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Adam Blum. I work with public safety and the judiciary. Prior to coming to the LBO, I worked in local government for the city of Kansas City, including time in their budget office, and most recently with Dakota County.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, the final members of the team are Joe Harney and Laura Seco.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Joe Harney. I am the LBO analyst responsible for state government, taxes, and pensions. Prior to joining the LBO, I was a capital budget analyst for the city of Minnetonka. And before that, I worked for the city of Chicago
and the Illinois Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Laura Seco. My policy area is transportation, and prior to joining the LBO, I spent 12 years in the banking and brokerage industry as a fraud and money laundering investigator.
Okay, thank you. And I think we're going to have to adjourn, but I want to thank your staff for sitting in. It gives us an idea of the faces that go behind some of the names and some of the people that you may be interacting with from time to time when we request fiscal notes.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry it had to be fairly quick, but we had a fairly good discussion, which I think probably helped some of your staff, especially with the forecast and kind of getting a little better picture of how this committee operates, but there are many committees I'll be working with. And I should point out to members, there is no change with the revenue notes, which go through the tax committee, and the tax chair is here. This is strictly the revenue, or not the revenue side, but the appropriation side, where we're dealing with the fiscal notes. Revenue notes are a different breed. So with that, meeting adjourned, and thank you.